Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk about those enemies, foreign and domestic, the extent to which they are operating against the best interests, indeed, perhaps the very survival of our country, with a man who has devoted his entire professional life, as best I can tell, to protecting us from such enemies. His name is Charles Samfatis. I'm proud to say he is one of our featured guests on this program, usually about this time each week, and a man who has brought a tremendous amount of experience, both as an Army officer, as a undercover Central Intelligence Agency operative, as a former Assistant Attorney General out in Washington State, as an author, as a candidate for Congress, as the driving force behind a tremendously important online resource and magazine.com, which you can now find at Substack. Samfatis, welcome back, sir. Great to have you as always.
As always, great to be here. Thank you.
Look, I want to take advantage of your insights into the body politic and what is operating on it at the moment, Sam, not least drawing on your expertise as a former prosecutor. And that would be in connection with the, well, I was going to say prosecution, but I think persecution might be a better term for it, of our friend and colleague, Dr. Peter Navarro. He's just been convicted of two contempt of a congressional committee charges. And I wonder what you make of it and what it says about the judicial system and lawfare that seems to be afoot at the moment.
Well, I mean, Mr. Navarro is a patriot. He's a man of incredible substance. He's a man who's done incredible service to this country. His only crime is that he's a political opponent of an increasingly radicalized regime. And let's just be blunt. We don't want to face it maybe as Americans, but here's the reality. They have completely weaponized the law enforcement justice system against political opponents. They're day by day rapidly transforming into a third world country that we used to ridicule. That's where we are. Where this regime is focused on prosecuting and apparently imprisoning its political opponents. That's the reality. I was on another program the other day. There was a guy I respect on there very much who was talking about how bad things were, but then saying, you know, but at the end of the day, we got to respect the rule of law. We got to respect this. We sort of can't contemplate that we live without a rule of law. My response was 100% agree. We need rule of law, but what you're missing is we're losing it, or we've lost it already. Could anything be more dangerous to the Republic? I mean, this is horrifying.
Yeah. And, you know, Sam, I think we've talked about this before because it weighs on me. It's so fundamental to the constitutional republic that we have been blessed to inherit from people who fought and died, including members of your family, I know, to protect it. And the corrosiveness of these kinds of selective prosecutions at best, at worst, as you say, complete weaponization of the judiciary, the Justice Department, the FBI, and so on. It's hard to overstate how toxic it is. And I keep coming back, as we've, again, I think discussed before, to this question that is also worrying, and that is this really designed to provoke a response from patriotic Americans that don't like what they're seeing and feel compelled to act, God forbid, violently in response, and thereby justify the kind of, oppression that I think these guys have in mind is, I don't know if it's a third world country or a second world country. You know, it seems pretty tyrannical to me.
Well, I think if you look at the evidence objectively, again, I think the problem is most Americans just don't really want to face the enormity and gravity of it. They just kind of want to think, it'll be okay. I think that's the conclusion you have to reach, that it is deliberate. Even if it is not deliberate, if it is somehow unintentional, which is hard to figure out how that works, isn't that where ultimately we end up? I mean, as I was saying the other day to this other gentleman, it's like, how long do you think law-abiding Americans will continue to abide by the law when they finally absorb the fact that it only applies to them, that it only applies to those that support the regime? And if you, I mean, at some point, yes, that's where you are. I mean, go back to, you know, political philosophy classes that I probably slept through at Johns Hopkins long, long ago. John Locke in The State of Nature, right? We come together, we form an association, we agree to abide by rules. We no longer exercise routinely the right to self-defense because we trust this body politic we've created. Well, we're destroying it. And I'm very active, as you know, in politics at the grassroots level in Pennsylvania. The specter of some mass domestic violent extremist movement, it's fantasy. There is it's not fantasy, it's a deliberate creation of our opponent. There is no such thing. But at what point will the law-abiding citizen just say, well, listen, man, the law, there is no law anymore. Why should I pay attention to the law?
A further consideration and weaponization that seems to be afoot that may bear on all of this, as we talked about in a webinar of our Committee on the Present Danger of China recently, is that what they're doing to the United States military as well to, well, fundamentally transform it, Sam, it creates the possibility, and again, it's hard to countenance, let alone look on with indifference, that the military might be used to oppress those otherwise law-abiding citizens in the event that a pretext can be found for doing so. And to that end, we're seeing this radicalization really along cultural Marxist lines. People use the term woke, and I think that's misleading and insufficient unto the day, shall we say. But you've served in the uniform of the United States Army, Sam, and I know we've talked about what your concerns are as well, but just whether it's C.Q. Brown, the nominee to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or literally dozens of others who are now awaiting promotion, all of whom have embraced this idea that the United States is a systemically racist country and we need to indoctrinate our military personnel and the idea that critical race theory is true and, you know, a corrective and diversity, equity, inclusion, on and on, Sam. Where does that leave us militarily, but also as a society, do you think?
Well, it leaves us with the plot of it, what we would have considered a dystopian novel, right? Not so long ago. Okay, that's crazy, maybe entertaining to read, but never happened. That's a very real thing. I mean, these people are revolutionaries, and increasingly those are the folks that they are putting in positions of power. I should add, as I think you and I have touched on before, increasingly, in addition to the fact they're revolutionaries, it's hard to find amongst them anybody who you really think could win a fight with the communist Chinese or any other serious adversary, because they spend all their time on sitting behind a desk or ideology or PowerPoint presentations.
And promoting this ideology suggests, we'd be better off under their system than ours. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Sam Faddis, we have to take a very short break. We'll be right back with more. And you're not going to want to miss what Sam has to say about the border, among other things, right after this. All right, my friend.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Patriotic Americans in Michigan have been fighting to protect their part of the U.S. heartland from being despoiled and possibly weaponized by Goshen, a company that not only works for the Chinese Communist Party, it is a CCP enterprise through and through. For example, 500 employees, the parent company that wholly owns Goshen's American subsidiary, were recently shown visiting party landmarks in People's Liberation Army uniforms, vowing to give their lives for the CCP. Incredibly, Michigan's governor and state legislature have insisted on giving Goshen over $700 million in subsidies, tax credits, and other inducements to establish a potentially toxic lithium battery plant in a pristine part of the state. That amounts to yet another case of American elites blithely funding our mortal enemy's installation of a ticking environmental, if not actually a literal, time bomb here. Stop Goshen now. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Sam Faddis is in the house, virtually, I'm proud to say. We are talking about... well, threats to the Republic. And one of them, it seems unbelievably, is emanating now from, it appears, Sam, the American Library Association. I think I've got that right. What on earth is going on with those folks? And what does it mean in this whole mix of inculcating into our population a hatred for our country and a love for everything that it is, historically at least, opposed to?
Well, again, Frank, I think the average American kind of doesn't really want to face the reality of what's going on, and I get it, right? You've got other things going on, and you don't really want to admit that your country is burning to the ground. But that's what we're facing, and as you keep saying, this is Marxist ideology. You know, I've worked against it all over the world. I know it when I see it. We've absorbed, I guess, the fact, or many of us have absorbed, that the public schools are busy just pumping this ideology into your kid's brain and have decided long ago that parents have no role in the upbringing of their kids. They know better. Now the American Library Association has elected this lady, Emily Drabinsky, as their president. The staggering thing about Ms. Drabinsky is not what her ideology is, because I think it's crazy radical. It's that she is so outspoken about it. There's no attempt to put any sugarcoating on it. She straight up, we wrote about this at Ann Magazine the other day. I would encourage people to just look at all the links that we included, which includes a lot of video of her talking. So you don't have to take my word for it. Just listen to her. She's a radical communist. She describes herself as a queer Marxist. And she hates everything about American society, American history, and American political system. And she believes expressly and says expressly that she believes it's the role of librarians to assist in destroying that system and grabbing a hold, in particular, of your kids' minds and pumping them full of poison. And again, just listen, take 5 minutes and listen to Ms. Drabinsky. And the staggering thing to me is not that she thinks these things, is that she just smacks you in the face with it over and over and over. You're a bunch of evil people. You want to kill blacks. You want to kill Jews. You hate gay people. And I'm coming for you.
Sam, I gather that this gal has been elected to this role by the membership of the people who staff our libraries. And again, I guess maybe secondary only to the school system, the vehicle that the librarians have to inculcate through the books that are prominently featured in their shelves and display cases and the like, as well as the programs that take place there. And the drag queen story hours, I guess, come to mind in connection with the latter, the book burning charge that they're pushing out that is a response to the former is, it just all suggests that we've really lost our moorings. I mean, there was a time when people like this would be quite, I think, understandably well, not just marginalized, but probably imprisoned for, you know, seditious activity. But today they're being promoted to positions of considerable influence. I just wonder, do you think this really is representative of the sentiment of the people who run our libraries?
Yeah, unfortunately I do. I mean, this lady was elected in a popular election by the delegates from all over the country of the American Library Association. So she didn't just sort of stage a coup. And they're apparently gaga over her. They think this is exactly where they should go. And here's another thing that I think people need to absorb. I mean, back to my point that I think a lot of Americans would sort of like to just tune this out. This agenda is being pushed everywhere. You know, you hear this and you think, yeah, in San Francisco, they're crazy. In Manhattan, they do crazy stuff. No, everywhere, folks. I mean, I live in a rural county in Northeast Pennsylvania. Our local library is, county library is currently considering a measure, which we're fighting, which will allow minors 13 and over to check out books and prevent their parents from knowing what they checked out and what they're reading. It will be kept confidential from their parents. So this is kind of the heart of the issue, right? It's, we're going to, and available in this library and all libraries across every state, you're going to find all sorts of stuff pushing BLM ideology, Marxist ideology, transgender ideology.
Pornography.
In addition to all pornography, expressive, in addition to all sorts of other stuff, it's just age inappropriate, right? And instead of allowing they are deliberately proposing to adopt a policy that will prevent parents from knowing what their children are reading. If you ask to see what your kid's reading, they will tell you, you have to get a court order. That's literally from the language. So the library is going to grab a hold of your kid's mind and pump stuff directly into it.
And Sam, I mean, that's kind of the micro aspect of this. The macro is just clearly an assault on the family as a critical element of society. And that's Marxism through and through. It's it has to be fought. And thank you for what you're doing, Sam, at the local level, as well as, of course, through platforms like this nationally. Let me turn, we've only got a couple of minutes left, Sam, unfortunately, to one of your other products at andmagazine.com. You entitled it Joe and the Cartels Loot America. Give us a synopsis of what you are finding there.
Well, there have been a number of recent reports, and actually, if you look at the Department of Justice website and Homeland Security and so forth, you'll see that this is acknowledged. All of this mass looting that we're seeing across cities where groups go in and smash and grab in jewelry stores and so forth is being orchestrated by organized gangs run by the Mexican drug cartels. So here we got Joe Biden that allows fentanyl to come across the border. The drug cartels now make more money from moving people than they do from moving drugs, thanks to Joe. I mean, from the illegals coming across the border. And now, again, courtesy of this whole Democratic agenda of defunding the police and not prosecuting anybody who steals less than $1,000. That's the rule in most major cities now. So you now have organized gangs moving around. They show up, they go in, they case the place, they want them to Home Depot. In advance, they have identified everything they're going to steal. Each individual guy walks out with less than $1,000. So even if he's caught, nothing happens to him. And I think it was last year, most recent year for which figures are available, $90 billion in losses. Stores are, you know, every major city, the downtown shopping areas are boarded up storefronts now. They're all, stores are fleeing. Again, courtesy of a Democratic Party agenda.
To what end, Sam? Where does that agenda ultimately take us?
To the destruction of the country. I mean, Mayor Eric Adams the other day in New York City said in regard to the migrant crisis in the country, this is going to destroy New York City because they're $12 billion in the hole. And my first thought was, well, Eric, that was the purpose. Yes, it's going to destroy New York City, and that's not unintentional.
In fact, we're talking about the mayor of New York City. It was his purpose, presumably, when he said, "Y'all come. We're a sanctuary city for anybody who wants to make their way to New York." And he's reaping the whirlwind. But unfortunately, Sam, as you say, so is his, you know, electorate. So are the people of New York, and those who, you know, have made it one of the great cities of the world. Yes. And it pains me to say, you know, so much of this is by design, obviously, and yes, is having the intended effect of destroying our republic, which is why we're broadcasting this show and featuring people like you who are raising the alarm about it and taking leadership and trying to push back. Thank you, Sam, for what you do, my friend, especially at substack.com. Check out andmagazine.com there. God bless you. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, more straight ahead.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by the Honorable Robert Charles, a former Assistant Secretary of State during the George W. Bush administration, but a man who has served his country in a variety of other capacities as a naval intelligence officer, as a senior congressional staff member, as a clerk on the Ninth Circuit's Court of Appeals, among other things. We're always delighted to have him with us these days. Robert Charles is the spokesman for a terrific organization which I'm proud to be a member. It's called the Association of Mature American Citizens. You can follow his work there and that of the organization at amac.us. Mr. Secretary, good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Frank, I'm always glad you're doing your show, and I'm always glad to be on it.
Thank you, as am I. I wanted to start by drawing upon your time in the government, particularly your time in uniform, Bobby, to discuss a little bit the subject of a important webinar that, as we speak, is still to be conducted, but will be available at presentdangerchina.org by the time this program airs. Its title is Removing the Marxists and Rebuilding the Military. And I'm really concerned, Bobby, that what we're seeing, it's often described as wokeism, but it's really, as I think we've discussed before, cultural Marxism. And it's being embraced not only by civilians in the Pentagon and Biden administration more generally, but a number of our senior military personnel as well, including the man that Joe Biden has nominated to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top military officer. What are we to make of the prospect that, you know, senior leadership in our armed forces are embracing a doctrine, well, a strategy that is designed to destroy institutions like the military.
You know, there are layers to your question, Frank. You know, history is made incrementally, and we lose our freedoms incrementally often, far more frequently than we do in one fell swoop. And that's the real threat. The second thing is that Marxism was really afoot in this country back in the late 20s, 30s, and then it became afoot again in the 50s, and it is afoot again now. And, it, you know, people would like to believe, we would all like to believe that, to borrow from Upton Sinclair, it can't happen here. The problem is it can happen here. And we have to be constantly on guard for it in the civilian and the military worlds. But when it happens in the military world, it's like a cancer metastasizing to a vital organ, perhaps the most vital organ. Because ultimately, if the military is not prepared to fight and win, if it does not itself believe in America as America, qua Bill of Rights, if it does not believe itself in these things, then the power to win against an enemy, as Sun Tzu also said very clearly, if you can defeat them by just changing the way they think, and then we've defeated ourselves. So it is a very real problem, Frank. And I'll tell you, having been in the military, I was in at a time when in my 10 years, I loved the people around me. They all loved this country. They worked to be physically, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally strong every day as individuals, and they believed that was how the nation itself stayed strong. There is an opportunity. I'll end with this piece here on this question, Frank. There is an opportunity cost every single time you make a bad decision, because that could have been, should have been, and ultimately might have had to be a good decision. And so as we see China rising, as we see Iran reaching out, as we see about a dozen other potential offenders and our own allies becoming weak-kneed because we're not strong enough to project power the way we always have, we are going to face opportunity costs. And I think the biggest problem we've got is that if we don't understand the enemy at our feet, we will never understand the enemy on the horizon.
Well, I'm more worried about the enemy at our throat at the moment rather than at our feet. But wherever they are, the issue of leadership, and I think you said it so well, Bobby, is paramount here. Yeah. And we're asking, as you know, better than I, those in uniform to make the ultimate sacrifice for this country, to be willing to do so. And at the same time, it is now the purpose of the Defense Department, I think some tell us, to the detriment of training for the military mission itself, to put a premium on training that indoctrinates them in a hatred of our country, a country that is systemically racist and flawed beyond, you know.
I really hope, this is a longer conversation, but I really hope that you're wrong. Even as I fear that there's truth in some of what you're saying here, because the people I served with and those that I know who are still in the military certainly love this country. And frankly, a lot of those who are out of the military would immediately seek their commission back if this country were attacked. At the same time, the notion, this opportunity cost idea, which is really what you're expanding on, is a very real one. If you spend your time worrying about whether your promotion or whether your fit rep, we call them, is going to be based on how you treated somebody based on their color in other words, if the whole thing becomes, did you properly follow the protocol for wokeism or for Marxism, and that's what your fit rep is based on, well, then you've got a big problem. If instead you say, no, this is a meritocracy, and it doesn't matter what color we are, what size we are, what shape we are, what sex we are, what matters is, are you going to execute as a warrior? Are you? And what do warriors do, Frank? They only do two things, and we do them in all kinds of things. I was an intelligence officer, but their mission at large is to both prevent wars and to win wars. So that means to cause people to decide not to kill us, and should we be attacked, to kill. That's the whole point of the military. And so if you don't have that, you don't have defense. If you don't have defense, you don't have national security. If you don't have national security at the borders and internationally, then you don't have it internally. So that it's a very plain, vanilla, sort of a statement of fact.
Well, look, like you, I hope this is not what's happening in the military, but the evidence is now overwhelming that when just start with critical race theory, it is by design divisive.
Yeah.
It sets people against one another, which is exactly the opposite of the kind of unit cohesion you talked about. That's,
you know, vital. It's not only
to say, Frank, nothing of a meritocracy.
You know, Frank, it is not only against the ideas that you and I articulate. It is actually against the heart and cornerstone of what the American dream represents, of what Martin Luther King talked about out on the National Mall. You either believe in America and the American dream and the idea that I want to be my best so that I can pursue happiness and prosperity, and I want my neighbor to have that same option, and this is the only place in the world which has sworn itself to that mission, or you don't believe in that.
No, and if instead you believe that it's a systemically racist place and whites are inherently supremacist and blacks are inherently victims and there's nothing that can be done to change it. I mean, it's outrageous that this is even operating inside the military, let alone that the guy who has now been nominated to become its top officer is a champion of this and diversity, equity, inclusion, and all the rest of it. These are racist practices, and they're devastating to good order and discipline. And I just wanted to say, Bobby, whatever we hope is the case, the evidence, not only of what C.Q. Brown, this nominee to become the chairman, is thinking, but dozens and dozens and dozens of others whose nominations at the moment are being held up, thanks be to God, by Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, awaiting, you know, a proper review of their, well, not only their conduct and their performance, but also their adherence to this radical cultural Marxist agenda.
You know, the great irony
is Frank, vital that they get that right.
It is vital to get it right. And the great irony is, Frank, that every one of the Tuskegee Airmen believed deeply both in unit cohesion and in America. There was racism, and they wanted to get rid of the racism. But they believed that America would give them a shot, and many of them later went on and did great things. The reality is you either believe that this country is aspiring to freedom in every meaning of that word, or you don't. You believe in something different. If you believe in something different, you really don't belong in the military, for sure. But, you know, maybe you should go knock on China's door or go move to Venezuela, because that's not... We believe in the American dream because it has worked. And it works to lift every single human being that will pronounce it as their effort, their kind of compass. And you know, I have employees and I work with other people and all my life. If somebody is aspiring to get ahead and they're honest and they're working hard, by God, I will do everything in my power to help them get ahead, even if they don't want to work for me, right? That's America. But if you give up on that and you think Marxism and Bolshevism and top-down suppression and one-party government is the way, and then you want to infuse it into the military, well, you might as well just, again, you know, change the label at the top as to China, not America, because that's not us.
Bobby Charles, hold the thought. We'll be right back with more on the other side of a short break, including a conversation with Mr. Secretary about the threat to other elements of our government as well. Stay tuned. Let me do that again. Sorry. Mr. Secretary, hold the thought. We'll be right back with much more on both the military and on other aspects of our government similarly under siege from the cultural Marxists.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Patriotic Americans in Michigan have been fighting to protect their part of the U.S. heartland from being despoiled and possibly weaponized by Goshen, a company that not only works for the Chinese Communist Party, it is a CCP enterprise through and through. For example, 500 employees, the parent company that wholly owns Goshen's American subsidiary, were recently shown visiting party landmarks in People's Liberation Army uniforms, vowing to give their lives for the CCP. Incredibly, Michigan's governor and state legislature have insisted on giving Goshen over $700 million in subsidies, tax credits, and other inducements to establish a potentially toxic lithium battery plant in a pristine part of the state. That amounts to yet another case of American elites blithely funding our mortal enemy's installation of a ticking environmental, if not actually a literal, time bomb here. Stop Goshen now. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with the Honorable Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, now a spokesman for AMAC.us. We're always glad to have you with us. And we were talking about the military. You had a further point you wanted to make in conclusion.
My final point, really, Frank, was that we not only need capability, that is to say, fidelity to the American dream, et cetera, within and training and the material to support from within the military. And that's what you and I are talking about, leadership at that level. We also need a willingness at the top to use that military power. So if we're going to deter China from taking Taiwan or the Sakhalin Islands or something else, or intimidating one of our allies, never mind intimidating them all the way over to Europe, we have to be able and willing, both able and willing. And Ronald Reagan, to his great credit, was both. And when Iran, for example, started striking tankers or actually mined the Persian Gulf, he literally destroyed half of the Iranian Navy. And I will never forget, the press was all over him afterwards and said, "Sir, you've started a war with Iran. Are we at war with Iran?" And Reagan turned around and over his shoulder said, "No, we're not. We're not at war with Iran, because they wouldn't be as stupid as that. Are there any other questions?" And onward they went. And then they ended the Iran-Iraq war because they feared us. That's deterrence. So in the end, peace through strength.
Yeah, you served with him in the White House. You know how important that was to his entire presidency. And I think you're right. It's the only formula
it's
for
the
national
only
security policy that works, Bobby. Let me turn to another institution that it seems to me is now in the hands of cultural Marxists and being weaponized against patriots. And I consider Peter Navarro to be a preeminent American patriot, former trade advisor in the White House to President Trump, and a man who I think contributed enormously to the course correction that Donald Trump made with respect to policy towards communist China. Long overdue, desperately needed, now largely rescinded, alas. But the attack on Peter Navarro, using the, you know, Justice Department to bring charges against him for contempt of the January 6th committee. I've just done a commentary saying, Bobby, that I think everybody except those who were involved in it directly or otherwise benefiting from it had contempt for the January 6th committee. Sure. But Peter Navarro has been singled out, now convicted. What are we to make of this, as it seems to me, another example of, political warfare, using the judicial arm to do it.
As you know, Frank, I was a litigator. I was a clerk on the U.S. Court of Appeals, Ninth Circuit. I want to unpack this as honestly and directly and succinctly as I can. there is no question that we believe, or we should believe, that no one is above the law. Okay, that is a Montesquieu type, Magna Carta type understanding that the king himself is not above the law. However, when we use that phrase, is not above the law, what we mean by the law is that the law is a fair and properly administered series of rules and principles in which we can believe.
Equally when applied.
Well, of course, equally and properly and due with due process applied and et cetera. But the bottom line here is fairly applied. The bottom line here is that when you politicize the judicial branch, and they've done it both vertically and horizontally, you end up in a position where people no longer trust what is being called the law, because what should be enforced as the law is not. And what is being enforced is essentially the criminalization of politics. So when I say vertically and horizontally, let me just be succinct about that. You have a state-level prosecutor who yesterday or the day before in Georgia harangued about the fact that there was intrusion because the legislative side, including the U.S. Congress, is questioning the integrity and the constitutionality and the motivations for what is a plainly political prosecution. So she is arguing that the federal government, in its oversight role, constitutionally provided, has no right to look at what could be actually criminal behavior by her in attacking someone else for what she asserts is criminal behavior. And then you have the horizontal. You have the United States Justice Department deployed to essentially take down the next potential president because he's from the other party. And when the other branch, separation of powers problem we've got here, when the other branch, the legislative branch, the Congress, seeks documents from them, seeks to get some degree of accountability, they stiff arm them. So here's the problem, Frank. While no one is above the law, that means prosecutors themselves are not above the law. And an attorney general of the United States, as John Mitchell so sadly learned and spent time behind bars for not understanding, when attorney generals of the United States violate the law, or a prosecutor does, they can also be prosecuted. And I would just end with the statement that I hope that states' attorneys general, understanding that their populations are being disenfranchised in this election cycle by a set of prosecutors, two at the state level, one at the federal level, who are obviously seeking to interfere with the election. They're lining up their briefing schedule against the primary schedule. They're going after somebody on things that are constitutionally inappropriate. If they understand the magnitude of this, then either at their using their own state laws or using the federal statute, 18 U.S.C. 595, they ought to consider bringing charges against these prosecutors for election interference. You know, I can tell you all day long that I'm a fair-minded guy, Frank, but if I behave like I'm a politically motivated, non-fair-minded guy, anti-constitutionalist, even though I tell you I am one, you got to be smart enough to say, no, get down off that block, Bobby, you're not. And that's what we got to be saying to these prosecutors.
It's a fascinating idea that the state attorneys general might have a role in this, because the process, as you've described it, Bobby, of eroding the rule of law,
yes,
now seems to have gotten to the point where Congress seems incapable of responding to restore the principle, the fundamental principle of equal justice under the law. Bobby, we have to take one last break. When we come back, I want to visit with you a little bit about a very important piece that you had the other day, I believe, at amac.us about doing what the left always does, which is play games with words, changing the plain meaning of terrorism, for example, and what that in fact suggests is afoot in terms of policy and its implications for all of us. We'll be right back with more with Robert Charles of AMAC.us right after this. Welcome back. We're concluding our conversation with Robert Charles. He served, among other things, as a congressional counsel for Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, as well as an assistant secretary in the State Department for George W. Bush. And Bobby, in the course of that long career, you had an awful lot of opportunity to take stock personally, firsthand, to work against as well, terrorism. That term seems now to be being adulterated or morphed by those who would deflect it from foreign enemies who use terror as a tactic to what are basically political opponents domestically. Talk us through what that involves, first of all, and what it portends.
Yeah, I think I'll do this in just two simple ways, Frank. First, I'll say that George Orwell was right, that when those that seek to dominate and suppress, particularly, and he was talking about the communists, and that's really what we're talking about here, the rise of Marxism. When they seek to do that, they will begin changing the meaning of words. And when you have an administration and an entire movement dedicated to the proposition of redefining words, not just terrorism, but man and woman, and we could make a long list here, you know you're in new and deep and dangerous waters. And the sharks out there are basically redefining the way that we talk with each other, and terrorism is being used to describe parents. In fact, this attorney general defended using a statute to persecute, I will say, not just prosecute, parents who speak up at board meetings. That task force, by the way, that was convened to do that is still in existence. And then they use, you know, words like enemies of the people, the president of the United States, to describe the opposing party. Let's be crystal clear about that. That phrase was used in only two places with constancy. One was the French Revolution, which destroyed the entire Christian community and frankly, the entire country of France when it happened, and for all the outcomes that we might celebrate. And the other were the Bolsheviks, who destroyed Russia and turned it into a Soviet state. So that phrase is a very interesting phrase to have used. The second big thing I'm just going to say is that terrorism is a real thing, Frank, and you know this and I know this, but one of the things that I highlighted at AMAC.us in that story was standing in front of the Khobar Towers in Dahran just after they were destroyed by the equivalent of thousands of pounds of TNT in a truck that had been placed there by terrorists. Radical Islamic terrorists. And it killed a number of Americans. It could have killed a lot more if there had not been a very heroic sergeant who came down through realizing that that truck didn't belong there and in a matter of seconds getting a lot of people out. But I'll tell you, and I probably shouldn't say this on air, but I'm going to say it. Standing in front of those cubicles, the front of which was blown off, the backs of which were splattered side to side, top to bottom with American blood, was a heart-stopping kind of thing to see. And every single 8x8 blocks, 8 apartments up, 8 wide, every single one of them were destroyed by terrorism. That building was brought down, and I walked through the second building that was destroyed. It was unstable, but it was, you could walk through it. And Frank, terrorism is something that comes at us boldly, and we can describe other things as problems, but terrorism is a very real thing, and it typically comes from abroad. And to call us, because we're Americans who disagree with an administration, terrorists, is a fundamental miscarriage of both justice and language.
It is indeed. Another euphemism that was inserted, I was talking about this the other day with Robert Spencer, is the term violent extremism, Bobby. And as you may know, this has now been a term that is being applied to, at least potential violent extremists, and those parents at school boards and conservatives and veterans and gun owners and on.
Apparently they went into the Catholic Church and decided that the Catholic Church is the definition of
traditional
violent
Catholics.
That's a really shocking turn.
It is. And Bobby, I guess this is what I wanted to get at, is to the extent that these terms are now being applied to people who are patriotic Americans, law-abiding citizens, and are simply opponents of this president or politically on the other side from him and his party. Where does that take us as a country if it is allowed to continue to metastasize? We talked about cultural Marxism before. I would argue this is just another manifestation of the same basic stratagem of dividing, conquering, taking down.
Sure. I mean, you know, if your opponent is divided and confused, they're a lot easier to take down, either physically or from within. I would like to try to end on a hopeful note, Frank, and say that I would like to believe that it takes us to the year 2024, November, when Americans have, for the first time, a greater degree of self-awareness than they currently have. And they actually say to themselves, we are not going to let this happen. We are going to stand firm. We are going to return to us the sovereignty that we have given to these elected leaders. And now we're going to re-give that sovereignty to someone who understands that limited government and the preservation of our rights really does matter. We really do care about it. So the short answer to your question is it can go in the direction of Bolshevism. The longer answer is I sure hope it doesn't. And the way that it doesn't is we step up for our rights in 2024.
Well, that is a hopeful note, and it starts with a hope that there will be free and fair elections, and it takes a lot of hope to overcome concerns that enough hasn't been done to remedy problems that were identified in 2020.
Well, AMAC, to be honest, Frank, AMAC has worked with state legislatures across the United States, and it isn't me, but AMAC has helped every single legislature in the country has looked to revamp pieces. Now, not all of them have done it, but most of them have done it to literally revamp the way things worked in 2020. So we should believe in our vote. We need to believe in our vote.
We have to believe in it, and we have to be able to cast it without interference or manipulation. And a topic for another day is the research that Dr. Robert Epstein has been doing into the role that Google has been playing in manipulating votes, quite apart from all of the rest of the machinery and so on. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. It's always good to catch up with you, and I appreciate you giving us an extra segment this week. God bless you. Keep up the great work at AMAC.us. I hope the rest of you will keep on coming back for more next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.